And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our return to Monday afternoon book reading. And we've been reading At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. But before we go any further, a word from the people who help make our little station the community station that it is.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700.
And they're open 9:30 to 4:30 on weekdays. The branch will now be closed on Saturdays.
A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or source from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who, as I said, help make our little station possible. And we have been reading H.P. Lovecraft's Mountains of Madness to revise for you. It's about an expedition that Lovecraft wrote about, fictitiously of course, being made in the 1930s to an Antarctica that really hadn't been all that much explored. So he was able to sort of write of the place in a way that we couldn't really write of it today, as a place of mystery, as a place of possible previous civilizations. And of course, we've reached the point where the forward base found strange life forms, long dead, it seemed, and now our hero has actually flown with a friend and they are investigating the system that they found. A system that is alien, that is very ancient, and that is quite worrying for these scientists. The curious cave mouths, near which the odd formations seem most abundant, presented another, albeit a lesser puzzle, because of their regularity of outline. They were, as Lake's bulletin had said, often approximately square or semicircular, as if the natural orifices had been shaped to greater symmetry by some magic hand. Their numerousness and wide distribution were remarkable, and suggested that the whole region was honeycombed with tunnels dissolved out of limestone strata. Such glimpses as we secured did not extend far within the caverns, but we saw that they were apparently clear of stalactites and stalagmites. Outside, those parts of the mountain slopes adjoining the apertures seemed invariably smooth and regular. And Danforth thought that the slight cracks and pittings of the weathering tended toward unusual patterns. Filled as he was with the horrors and strangeness discovered at the camp where we found bodies and people missing, the dogs destroyed, he hinted that the pittings vaguely resembled those baffling groups of dots sprinkled over the primeval greenish soapstones so hideously duplicated on the madly conceived snow mounds above the six buried monstrosities. We had risen gradually in flying over the higher foothills, and along toward the relatively low pass we had selected. As we advanced, we occasionally looked down and at the snow and ice of the land route, wondering whether we could have attempted the trip with the simpler equipment of earlier days. Somewhat to our surprise, we saw that the terrain was far from difficult as such things go, and that despite the crevasses and other bad spots, it would not have been likely to deter the sledges of a Scott, a Shackleton, or an Amundsen. Some of the glaciers appeared to lead up to wind-bared passes with unusual continuity, and upon reaching our chosen pass, we found that its case formed no exception. Our sensations of tense expectancy as we prepared to round the crest and peer out over an untrodden world can hardly be described on paper, even though we had no cause to think the regions beyond the range essentially different from those already seen and traversed. The touch of evil mystery in these barrier mountains and in the beckoning sea of opalescent sky glimpsed betwixt their summits was a highly subtle and attenuated matter not to be explained in literal words. Rather, was it an affair of vague psychological symbolism and aesthetic association, a thing mixed up with exotic poetry and paintings and with archaic myths lurking in shunned and forbidden volumes. Even the wind's burden held a peculiar strain of conscious malignity, and for a second it seemed that the composite sound included a bizarre whistling or piping over a wide range as the blast swept in and out of the omnipresent and resonant cave mouths. There was a cloudy note of reminiscent repulsion in this sound, as complex and unplaceable as any of the other dark impressions. We were now, after a slow ascent, at a height of 23,570 feet, according to the aneroid, and had left the region of clinging snow definitely below us. Up here were only dark bare rock slopes and the start of rough-ribbed glaciers, but with those provocative cubes, ramparts and echoing cave mouths to add a portent of the unnatural, the fantastic and the dreamlike. Looking along the line of high peaks, I thought I could see the one mentioned by Paul Lake, with a rampart exactly on top. It seemed to be half lost in a queer Antarctic haze, such a haze, perhaps, as had been responsible for Lake's early notion of volcanism. The pass loomed directly before us, smooth and windswept, between its jagged and malignly frowling pylons. Beyond it was a sky fretted with swirling vapours and lighted by the low polar sun, the sky of that mysterious farther realm upon which we felt no human eye had ever gazed. A few more feet of altitude and we would behold that realm. Danforth and I, unable to speak except in shouts amidst the howling, piping wind that raced through the pass and added to the noise of the unmuffled engines, exchanged eloquent glances, and then, having gained those last few feet, we did indeed stare across the momentous divide and over the unsampled secrets of an elder and utterly alien Earth. Chapter 5. I think that both of us simultaneously cried out in mixed awe, wonder, terror, and disbelief in our own senses as we finally cleared the pass and saw what lay beyond. Of course, we must have had some natural theory in the back of our heads to steady our faculties for the moment. Probably we thought of such things as the grotesquely weathered stones of the Garden of the Gods in Colorado, or the fantastically symmetrical wind-carved rocks of the Arizona desert. Perhaps we even half thought the sight of a mirage like that we had seen the morning before on the first approaching these mountains of madness. We must have had some such normal notions to fall back upon as our eyes swept that limitless, tempest-scarred plateau and grasped the almost endless labyrinth of colossal, regular, and geometrically eurythmic stone masses which reared their crumbled and pitted crests above the glacial sheet not more than 40 or 50 feet deep at its thickest and in places obviously thinner. The effect of the monstrous sight was indescribable. For some fiendish violation of known natural law seemed certain at the outset. Here on a hellishly ancient tableland, fully 20,000 feet high and in a climate deadly to habitation since pre-human age, not less than 500,000 years ago, there stretched nearly to the vision's limit a tangle of orderly stone which only the desperation of mental self-defence could possibly attribute to any but a conscious and artificial cause. We had previously dismissed, so far as serious thought was concerned, any theory that the cubes and ramparts of the mountainsides were other than natural origin. How could they be otherwise, when man himself could scarcely have been differentiated from the great apes at the time when this region succumbed to the present unbroken reign of glacial death? Yet now, the sway of reason seemed irrefutably shaken. For this cyclopean maze of squared, curved, and angled blocks had features which cut off all comfortable refuge. It was very clearly the blasphemous city of the mirage in stark, objective, and ineluctable reality. That damnable portent had had a material basis after all. There had been some horizontal stratum of ice dust in the upper air, and this shocking stone survival had projected its image across the mountains, according to the simple laws of reflection. Of course, the phantom had been twisted and exaggerated, and had contained things which the real source did not contain. Yet now, as we saw, that real source, we thought it even more hideous and menacing than its distant image. Only the incredible, inhuman massiveness of these vast stone towers and ramparts had saved the frightful thing from utter annihilation in the hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of years it had brooded there amidst the blasts of a bleak upland. Corona mundi, reef, roof of the world. All sorts of fantastic phrases sprang to our lips as we looked dizzily down at the unbelievable spectacle. I thought again of the eldritch primal myths that had so persistently haunted me since my first sight of this dead Antarctic world, of the demoniac plateau of Leng, of the Maigo or abominable snowmen of the Himalayas, or the narcotic manuscripts with their pre-human implications of the Cthulhu cult, of the Necronomicon and of the Hyperion legends of formless Tassagogua, and the worse than formless starspawn associated with that semi-entity. For boundless miles, in every direction, the thing stretched off with very little thinning. Indeed, as our eyes followed it to the right and the left along the base of the low, gradual foothills which separated it from the actual mountain rim, we decided that we could see no thinning at all, except for an interruption at the left of the pass through which we had come. We had merely struck at random a limited part of something of incalculable extent. The foothills were more sparsely sprinkled with grotesque stone structures linking the terrible city to the already familiar cubes and ramparts which evidently formed its mountain outposts. These latter, as well as the queer cave mouths, were as thick on the inner as on the outer sides of the mountains. The nameless stone labyrinth consisted for the most part of walls from 10 to 150 feet in ice-clear height, and of a thickness varying from 5 to 10 feet. It was composed mostly of prodigious blocks of dark primordial slate, schist and sandstone, blocks in many cases as large as 4 by 6 by 8 feet, though in several places it seemed to be carved out of a solid, uneven bedrock of Precambrian slate. The buildings were far from equal in size, there being innumerable honeycomb arrangements of enormous extent, as well as smaller separate structures. The general shape of these things tended to be conical, pyramidal, or terraced, though there were many perfect cylinders, perfect cubes, clusters of cubes, and other rectangular forms, and a peculiar sprinkling of angled edifices, whose five-pointed ground plan roughly suggested modern fortifications. The builders had made constant and expert use of the principle of the arch, and domes had probably existed in the city's heyday. the whole tangle was enormously weathered, and the glacial surface from which the towers projected was strewn with fallen blocks and immemorial debris. Where the glaciation was transparent, we could see the lower parts of the gigantic piles and noticed the ice-preserved stone bridges which connected the different towers at varying distances above the ground. On the exposed walls, we could detect the scarred places where other and higher bridges of the same sort had existed. Closer inspection revealed countless largish windows, some of which were closed with shutters of a petrified material, originally wood, though most gaped open in a sinister and menacing fashion. Many of the ruins, of course, were roofless and with uneven, though wind-rounded upper edges, whilst others of a more sharply conical or pyramidal model, or else protected by higher surrounding structures, preserved intact outlines despite the omnipresent crumbling and pitting. With the field glasses, we could barely make out what seemed to be sculptural decorations in horizontal bands, decorations including those curious groups of dots whose presence on the ancient soapstone now assumed a vastly larger significance. In many places, the buildings were totally ruined and the ice sheet deeply riven from the various geologic causes. In other places, the stonework was worn down to the very level of the glaciation. One broad swathe, extending from the plateau's interior to a cleft in the foothills about a mile to the left of the pass we had traversed, was wholly free from buildings and probably represented, we concluded, the course of some great river which in tertiary times, millions of years ago, had poured through the city and into some prodigious subterranean abyss of the Great Barrier Range. Certainly, this was above all a region of caves, gulfs, and underground secrets beyond human penetration. Looking back to our sensations and recalling our dazedness at viewing this monstrous survival from eons we had thought prehuman, I can only wonder that we preserved the semblance of equilibrium which we did. Of course, we knew that something, chronology, scientific theory, our own consciousness, was woefully awry, and we kept enough poise to guide the plane, observe the many things quite minutely, and take a careful series of photographs, which may yet serve both us and the world in good stead. In my case, ingrained scientific habit may have helped, for above all my bewilderment and sense of menace, there burned a dominant curiosity to fathom more of this age-old secret, to know what sort of beings had built and lived in this incalculably gigantic place, and what relation to the general world of its time or of other times so unique a concentration of life could have had. This place could be no ordinary city. It must have formed from the primary nucleus and centre of some archaic and unbelievable chapter of Earth's history, whose outward ramifications recalled only dimly in the most obscure and distorted myths, had vanished utterly amidst the chaos of Terran convulsions long before the human race we know had shambled out of apedom. Here sprawled a Pelagian megalopolis, compared with which the fabled Atlantis and Lemuria, Comorium and Usuldaurum and Olatoi in the land of Lomar are recent things of today, not even of yesterday. A megalopolis ranking with such whispered pre-human blasphemies as Volusia Rihlib, Ib in the land of Manar, and the nameless city of Arabia Deserta. As we flew above that tangle of stark Titan towers, my imaginations sometimes escaped all bounds and roved aimlessly in realms of fantastic associations, even weaving links betwixt this lost world and some of my own wildest dreams concerning the mad horror at the camp. The plane's fuel tank, in the interest of greater lightness, had been only partly filled, hence we now had to exert caution in our explorations. Even so, however, we covered an enormous extent of ground, or rather air, after swooping down to a level where the wind became virtually negligible. There seemed to be no limit to the mountain range or to the length of the frightful stone city which bordered its inner foothills. 50 miles of flight in each direction showed no major change in the labyrinth of rock and masonry that clawed up corpse-like through the eternal ice. There were, though, some highly absorbing diversifications. Such as the carvings on the canyon, where that broad river had once pierced the foothills and approached its sinking place in the Great Range. The headlands at the stream's entrance had been boldly carved into cyclopean pylons, and something about the ridgy, barrel-shaped designs stirred up oddly vague, hateful, and confusing self-remembrances in both Danforth and me. We also came upon several star-shaped open spaces, evidently public squares, and noted various undulations in the terrain. Where a sharp hill rose, it was generally hollowed out into some sort of rambling stone edifice, but there were at least two exceptions. Of these latter, one was too badly weathered to disclose what had been on the jutting eminence, while the other still bore a fantastic conical monument, carved out of the solid rock and roughly resembling such things as the well-known snake tomb in the ancient city of Petra. Flying inland from the mountains, we discovered that the city was not of infinite width, even though its length along the foothills seemed endless. After about 30 miles, the grotesque stone buildings began to thin out, and in 10 more miles, we came to an unbroken waste, virtually without signs of sentient artifice. The course of the river beyond the city seemed marked by a broad depressed line, while the land assumed a somewhat greater ruggedness, seeming to slope slightly upward as it receded in the mist-hazed west. So far we had made no landing, yet to leave the plateau without an attempt at entering some of the monstrous structures would have been inconceivable. Accordingly, we decided to find a smooth place on the foothills near our navigable pass, there grounding the plane and preparing to do some exploration on foot. Though these gradual slopes were partly covered with a scattering of ruins, low flying soon disclosed an ample number of possible landing places. Selecting that nearest to the pass, since our next flight would be across the Great Range and back to camp, we acceded and managed by about 12:30 p.m. in coming down on a smooth, hard snowfield, wholly devoid of obstacles and well adapted to a swift and favourable takeoff later on. It did not seem necessary to protect the plane with a snow banking for so brief a time, and in so comfortable an absence of high winds at this level, hence we merely saw that the landing skis were safely lodged and that the vital parts of the mechanism were guarded against the cold. For our foot journey, we discarded the heaviest of our flying furs and took with us a small outfit consisting of a pocket compass, hand camera, light provisions, voluminous notebooks and paper, geologist's hammer and chisel, specimen bags, coil of climbing rope, and powerful electric torches with extra batteries. This equipment having been carried in the plane on the chance that we might be able to effect a landing, take ground pictures, make drawings and topographical sketches, and obtain rock specimens from some bare slope, outcropping or mountain cave. Fortunately, we had a supply of extra paper to tear up, place in a spare specimen bag, and use on the ancient principle of hare and hounds for marking our course in any interior mazes we might be able to penetrate. This had been bought in case we found some cave system with air quite enough to allow such rapid and easy method in place of the usual rock-chipping method of trailblazing. Walking cautiously downhill over the crusted snow toward the stupendous stone labyrinth that loomed against the opalescent west, we felt almost as keen a sense of imminent marvels as we had felt on approaching the unfathomed mountain pass 4 hours previously. True, we had become visually familiar with the incredible secret concealed by the barrier peaks, yet the prospect of actually entering primordial halls reared by conscious beings perhaps millions of years ago, before any known race of men could have existed, was nonetheless awesome and potentially terrible in its implications of cosmic abnormality. Though the thinness of the air at this prodigious altitude made exertion somewhat more difficult than usual, both Danforth and I found ourselves bearing up very well and felt equal to almost any task which might fall to our lot. It took only a few steps to bring us to a shapeless ruin-worn level with the snow, while 10 or 15 rods further on there was a huge roofless rampart, still complete in its gigantic five-pointed outline and rising to an irregular height of 10 or 11 feet. For this latter we headed, and when at last we were able actually to touch its weathered cyclopean blocks, we felt that we had established an unprecedented and almost blasphemous link with forgotten eons normally closed to our species. The rampart, shaped like a star and perhaps 300 feet from point to point, was built of Jurassic sandstone blocks of irregular size, averaging 6 by 8 feet in surface. There was a row of arched loopholes or windows about 4 feet wide and 5 feet high, spaced quite symmetrically along the points of the star and at its inner angles, and with the bottoms about 4 feet from the glaciated surface. Looking through these, we could see that the masonry was fully 5 feet thick, and that there were no partitions remaining within, and that there were traces of banded carvings or bas-reliefs on the interior walls, facts we had indeed guessed before when flying low over this rampart and others like it. Though lower parts must have originally existed, all traces of such things were now wholly obscured by the deep layer of ice and snow at this point. We crawled through one of the windows and vainly tried to decipher the nearly effaced mural designs, but did not attempt to disturb the glaciated floor. Our orientation flights had indicated that many buildings in the city proper were less ice-choked, and that we might perhaps find wholly clear interiors leading down to the true ground level if we entered those structures still roofed at the top. Before we left the rampart, we photographed it carefully and studied its mortalist cyclopean masonry with complete bewilderment. We wished that Pabody were present, for his engineering knowledge might have helped us guess how such titanic blocks could have been handled in that unbelievably remote age when the city and its outskirts were built up. The half-mile walk downhill to the actual city, with the upper wind shrieking vainly and savagely through the skyward peaks in the background, was something whose smallest details will always remain engraved on my mind. Only in fantastic nightmares could any human beings but Danforth and me conceive such optical effects. Between us, the churning vapours of the west, lay that monstrous tangle of dark stone towers, its outre and incredible forms impressing us afresh at every new angle of vision. It was a mirage of solid stone. And, were it not for the photographs, I would still doubt that such a thing could be. The general type of masonry was identical with that of the rampart we had examined, but the extravagant shapes which this masonry took in its urban manifestations were past all description. Even the pictures illustrate only one or two phases of its infinite bizarrerie, endless variety, preternatural massiveness, and utterly alien exoticism. There were geometrical forms for which an Euclid could scarcely find a name, cones of all degrees of irregularity and truncation, terraces of every sort of provocative disproportion, shafts with odd bulbous enlargements, broken columns in curious groups, and five-pointed or ridged arrangements of mad grotesqueness. As we drew nearer, we could see beneath certain transparent parts of the ice sheet and detect some of the tubular stone bridges that connected the crazily sprinkled structures at various heights. Of orderly streets there seemed to be none, the only broad open swathe being a mile to the left, where the ancient river had doubtless flowed through the town and into the mountains. Our field glasses showed the external horizon bands of nearly effaced sculptures and dot groups to be very prevalent, and we could half imagine what the city must once have looked like, even though most of the roofs and tower tops had necessarily perished. As a whole, it had been a complex tangle of twisted lanes and alleys, all of them deep canyons and some little better than tunnels because of the overhanging masonry or overarching bridges. Now, outspread below us, it loomed like a dream fantasy against a westward mist through whose northern end the low reddish Antarctic sun of early afternoon was struggling to shine. And when for a moment that sun encountered a denser obstruction and plunged the scene into temporary shadow, the effect was subtly menacing in a way I can never hope to depict. Even the faint howling and piping of the unfelt wind in the great mountain passes behind us took on a wilder note of purposeful malignity. At the last stage of our descent to the town, it was unusually steep and abrupt, and a rock outcropping at the edge where the grade changed led us to think that an artificial terrace had once existed there. Under the glaciation, we believed there must be a flight of steps or its equivalent. When at last we plunged into the labyrinthine town itself, clambering over fallen masonry and shrinking from the oppressive nearness and dwarfing height of omnipresent crumbling and pitted walls, our sensations again became such that I marvel at the amount of self-control we retained. Danforth was frankly jumpy and began making some offensively irrelevant speculations about the horror at the camp, which I resented all the more because I could not help sharing certain conclusions forced upon us by many features of this morbid survival from nightmare antiquity. The speculations worked on his imagination too, for in one place, where a debris-littered alley turned a sharp corner, he insisted he saw faint traces of ground markings, which he did not like, whilst elsewhere he stopped to listen to a subtle, imaginary sound from some undefined point, a muffled musical piping, he said, not unlike that of the wind in the mountain caves, yet somehow disturbingly different. The ceaseless five-pointedness of the surrounding architecture and of the few distinguishable mural arabesques had a dimly sinister suggestiveness we could not escape, and gave us a touch of terrible, subconscious certainty concerning the primal entities which had reared and dwelt in this unhallowed place. Nevertheless, our scientific and adventurous souls were not wholly dead, and we mechanically carried out our program of chipping specimens from all the different rock types represented in the masonry. We wished a rather full set in order to draw better conclusions regarding the age of the place. Nothing in the great outer walls seemed to date from later than the Jurassic and Comanchean periods, nor was any piece of stone in the entire place of greater recency than the Pliocene age. In stark certainty, we were wandering amidst a death which had reigned at least 500,000 years, and in all probability, even longer. As we proceeded through this maze of stone-shadowed twilight, we stopped at all available apertures to study interiors and investigate entrance possibilities. Some were above our reach, whilst others led only to ice-choked ruins as unroofed and barren as the rampart on the hill. One, though spacious and inviting, opened on a seemingly bottomless abyss without visible means of descent. Now and then we had a chance to study the petrified wood of a surviving shutter, and were impressed by the fabulous antiquity implied in the still discernible grain. These things had come from Mesozoic gymnosperms and conifers, especially Cretaceous cycads, and from fan palms and earlier angiosperms of plainly tertiary date. Nothing definitely later than the Pliocene could be discovered. In the placing of these shutters, whose edges showed the former presence of queer and long-vanished hinges, usage seemed to be varied, some being on the outer and some on the inner side of the deep embrasures. They seemed to have become wedged in place, thus surviving the rusting of their former and probably metallic fixtures and fastenings. After a time, we came across a row of windows in the bulges of a colossal five-ridged cone of undamaged apex, which led into a vast, well-preserved room with stone flooring. But these were too high in the room to permit of descent without a rope. We had a rope with us, but did not wish to bother with this 20-foot drop unless obliged to, especially in this thin plateau air where the demands were made upon the hard action. This enormous room was probably a hall or concourse of some sort, and our electric torches showed bold, distinct and potentially startling sculptures arranged around the walls in broad, horizontal bands separated by equally broad strips of conventional arabesques. We took careful note of this spot, planning to enter here unless a more easily gained interior were encountered. Finally, we did encounter exactly the opening we wished, an archway about 6 feet wide and 10 feet high, marking the former end of an aerial bridge, which had spanned an alley about 5 feet above the present level of glaciation. These archways, of course, were flush with upper story floors, and in this case one of the floors still existed. The building, thus accessible, was a series of rectangular terraces on our left, facing westward. That across the alley, where the other archway yawned, was a decrepit cylinder with no windows, and with a curious bulge about 10 feet above the aperture. It was totally dark inside, and the archway seemed to open on a well of illimitable emptiness. Well, that's our book reading for today. We'll be back next Monday with the next instalment of H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. Well, stay, well, dry, Braidwood. It's been so wet and so humid, quite remarkable, and everywhere so sodden. I don't know about the grass in your yard, but I could disappear in it at the moment. At any rate, keep well, take care, stay safe.